People Leading People is a podcast about the stuff that pops up when you lead people at work. Join Brennan McEachran, CEO of Soapbox, and me, Jillian Bora, customer experience at Soapbox, as we interview the people leaders that inspire us most. Welcome to the first episode of People Leading People. Jill and Brennan here from Soapbox, and today we're chatting with Paul Tashima, co-founder and CEO at Nudge.ai, a relationship intelligence platform that helps you find and grow the right relationships that drive sales. Before founding Nudge, Paul built the customer success team at Eloqua as the SVP of product and customer success through to its acquisition by Oracle for $957 million US. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
You know, for those of you that don't know, Paul and I have been friends. I mean, we're like coming up in over 2 years now.
Yeah. You know, the first year I wasn't really so much your friend, but yeah, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
I was stretching.
Yeah.
Your story is really interesting. So I think maybe just to fill people in, can you kind of take us through the founding of Eloqua all the way to the founding of Nudge?
Sure. I was working at Rogers Communications back in, 1999, and I got asked to meet with the founders of Eloqua and join as like the second hire. And I wanted to do something different and try it. Like, I thought not a better time to try something new in my career. And so I joined in sales. And as soon as we got enough customers, I started to run the back side of the customer experience side.
Cool.
And over the last next 13 years, we built the company, took it public, survived a whole bunch of things, including a patent lawsuit, and then got bought by Oracle. And after that was done, I thought I wanted to do it again. And so we started Nudge.
Crazy. How long between being acquired by Oracle, earning out, I guess, was it, and then founding Nudge?
Well, so there's no earn out, which is lucky, because otherwise I wouldn't have earned out that much after a year. But it was about 2 months. I will say I would have taken longer, but my co-founder, Steve Wood, started coding and making me feel really guilty about not working on the new
right.
company. And so, it was about 2 months.
And then back at it.
Back at it, yeah.
So life changed in between. You had kids, you had a life, you had all of that fun. What's different from like a mental state perspective between where you were in maybe founding Eloqua and where you are now? Do you approach kind of the startup game differently?
You definitely approach it differently. I think the passion and trying and wanting to help people and work with people and build something great is probably the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you have a lot of different priorities in how you go about doing that. So, you know, at Eloqua, I just broke up with my girlfriend. I moved back home to my parents. I was making 18 grand a year.
Right.
But there's no tax on 18 grand a year. You just
right.
get the full amount from the government. You're getting paid 18. You're doing different, you know, you're focused on the business. You're doing all sorts of crazy things.
Right.
This time around, I have a family, but just as passionate about building a great business, you just focus on different things to get it done.
So one of the things I wanted to dive in with you is, I've heard this countless times. I have no kids, but I've heard being a parent makes you a better manager. You're kind of on the other side of that. Is that true? Or is there honesty there? Or is that something people make up?
I think being a parent makes you more patient in general, which makes you could translate to becoming a better manager at the workplace. I don't know if it directly translates, though. I do think that, you know, one of the things about management that always strikes me as interesting is people who say, wow, like all this stuff comes up all the time, you know, all this stuff out of nowhere and I can't get my job done. And I always used to take the approach that 40% of your day is to deal with stuff that comes
right.
up.
That's your
manager.
Job.
That's your job. And
yeah.
So if you don't like doing that, you shouldn't be a manager.
Yeah. You want to just work. That's fine. You can take that job.
Yeah.
So, okay. That's awesome. 40% of your time dealing with random stuff that pops up. Take me through what that 40%, or does that 40% change when you are at Nudge right now versus Oracle? Was there less things popping up versus, you know, and then I guess Eloqua is kind of, there's a transition period between small company and big company.
It's very different between Oracle to, you know, 120,000 people to Eloqua
right.
to now. But there's some common principles I think that are similar. You know, the hardest part about being a good manager is just figuring out, one, making it clear how you like to work with someone as a
yeah.
manager. Like, here's what I expect.
Yeah.
And being really clear about that. And then the second is understanding how those people that you're working with how they differ. How, you know, sometimes someone who knows the solution still wants to come complain about the problem, and you need to let them do that because that's how they think.
That's how they've been.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
how they and then another person needs 2 days to think about something quietly before you bug them again. And so it's the process of figuring out how your team works and how that works in the way you want it to be done is really the part that you have to learn and figure it out.
So that one of the things we talked about in our last meetup was on the topic of managing up was who owns that process of the manager and employee relationship and figuring that out. That seems like to me it would be on the manager, but there's a big part of the employee also has to figure out, you know, how to work with you and how to manage up. Is that all on the manager? Is that different? Is it different at a company of 100,000 people? Are they more aware of how to manage up at a big company or less aware at a small company, or is it about the same?
There's more structure in a big company, right? There's more structure in the roles, more structure in the reporting. There's more structure in what you're supposed to do every day, every week. And so there's definitely some people who are really good at managing up in a big company, whereas at small, it's more fluid.
Yeah.
I do think it's the job of the manager to set up the opportunity to allow your team to manage up. I do think it's the responsibility of the team member to take that opportunity. And
right.
I don't always feel people understand that. There's a two-way street on that.
So for the people listening who have the opportunity but maybe don't know if they're taking it, what is taking that opportunity look like if you're an employee?
So let me give a very tactical example.
Yeah.
Like every manager expects a certain set of standard metrics in the staff meeting for each of the different departments. Mm-hmm. These are the metrics I care about, right? Whatever. And then what you want to see is a transformation where the person who has to report their metrics starts realizing these aren't actually for you, Paul. These are for me to run my business.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I want to change the metrics, interpret them differently because they make more sense, if I want to use them in a way to help drive the business and show you the results, that's the transformation you want, is where it becomes less about not just managing up, but managing your own business.
Right. So take those metrics that I gave you, figure out, are they even the right ones? And if they're not, help us figure out what they should
be. Yeah, and then use them to manage the business when I'm not looking at the metrics.
Right, right. And if something's wrong, fix it.
I have a question. Hey, it's Jill here.
Hey, Jill.
Hi. So you talk about, you know, letting people know what their metrics are. What are other tactical things that as a manager you can do to set that expectation and be really clear about the environment you're creating and making people feel comfortable managing up?
I think that you need to, and some people actually write this down, but I think you need to be clear on the top things that bug or don't bug you. Like, I literally mean that. Like, if you ask them something to do and they don't do it in a certain way, great example, I ask my manager to send me an agenda day ahead of our one-on-one so I can think about it, not be reactionary, and actually come back to them with a couple things I want to talk about. And it bugs me if they don't do that. And you should tell them. It will bother me if you don't do that, because it's such a simple thing for you to do. Mm-hmm. And it also makes me realize that you're thinking ahead and using the time wisely when we're going to be there.
You're not just reacting.
You're not just half an hour before, oh my God, I got to send him an agenda, three bullets of whatever was in top of mind, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that point of tell them things that bug you and don't bug you and what your expectations are around those.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually, it's interesting. We were talking to a former team member of yours, Heather Fay. And one of the interesting things we got from her was her sheet. So she has this great sheet of like, this is what irks me, this is what doesn't irk me, this is how you should, manage me or what you should expect of me. And I was like, wow, that's great. Where'd you get that? She's like, Paul did this, so now I do it.
I don't even remember doing that.
So that's why I was like, man, we gotta sit down with Paul and figure out what else is that guy doing.
You know, I learned something from Heather Fay, though, and I'll just mention that. And this is where I think sometimes as a manager, you got to be open to learning about how better to manage from the people who are working with you. Is that, you know, you have this one-on-one, whether it's weekly or biweekly, whatever the structure is.
Yeah.
And typically, I would say most managers I talk to, they move that if other things come up.
Mm-hmm.
Sales calls, customers.
Yeah.
I think you just got to be careful how often you move that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Because it implicitly starts showing of you as a person who I'm working with are going to be the last priority in the day.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to do. Don't get me wrong. Like today, I have sales calls and I probably moved a one-on-one on Monday. But you know, you got to try and figure out how to get that more consistent.
Is that, do you find that true at Oracle just as much as it's true at Nudge?
Oh, so it's even more exasperated at a big company. At a big company, in my opinion, the seniority affects. It's immediately implied everything is lower priority if you're lower seniority in terms of meeting setup.
Right.
Like, there's no question. I mean, it's just how it is.
Right. So then if you're moving it, it's just the person is, you know, further degraded or whatever, right, in their importance.
I don't know if degraded is a strong word, but over time it creates a sense of you're not a priority for me. And the time we've allotted this week can be moved at any time. And if you had something important, you may have to wait a day or you may have to, you know. And I think that's, you got to be careful. It's going to happen, but you want to, you know, get 50% of them on time the same day, same hour that you always think it's going to be.
And I guess that's, you know, when you're talking about managing up and having them show up prepared, if they're sending you an agenda in advance and then you move it, that's sending a signal of importance, right? How important was that agenda to you?
Agreed. And then maybe you can't do weekly. If it's moving so much, maybe you should do it bi-weekly and just make sure you do it every 2 weeks.
So that's interesting. So we do, I talk to a lot of people about their one-on-ones and how they do them. And there's a lot of differences between how often they run them and what they talk about. So you do weekly. Is that right?
I do half hour every week with all my direct reports, but it's a small company right now, and we're moving pretty fast. So yes.
So how does that change? Where are the breaking points there? Do you go to, you know, monthly? Do you go to bi-weekly? Or how many people until you change that up?
I don't know if it's a number of people thing. I think it's I think different managers need different cadences, and I think that. You may get to a point with one manager that weekly is becoming redundant.
Right.
You may keep one manager at weekly. I think it's, you got to look at that on a person-to-person scenario.
See what they need.
Yeah, and also some of the departments have different stages of maturity, right? You have a group that may have grown a lot bigger and a group that's just a new department just starting up. And so it just depends on where you want to invest your time.
And you're doing weekly for 30 minutes. You must be talking about work activities. Or are you talking about personal stuff? As well.
It's primarily work activities, although I do always check in on that. So today at Nudge, and I wouldn't do this at larger scale, is that we have a weekly half hour with Aon, and then we have a weekly hour slot that is not so much a manage up opportunity, it's more a work together opportunity.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you were telling me about this. So this is, you sit down with them and you do work that helps them. Or they
come up with something they're working on and they want to learn because I've been here longer or I'm the founder. And so we work together on something more like I'm a team member than I'm their manager.
Right.
And they learn from that. I learn a bit from that. And then something gets done. So it's.
And shipped or whatever, put out.
Yeah.
Something, like
something
that.
Gets completed that, hey, you know, it's good.
All direct reports.
All direct reports get that hour.
How many direct reports are you doing?
I mean, I only got like 4 direct reports, so it's not crazy.
Right. But you're still talking about like almost one over a day or close to a day a week. Is basically doing those two things. If you kind of add that up, I don't know if that's true.
A regular work day a week, yes.
Okay,
6 hours.
That's correct. Yeah, that's
correct.
Yeah. So maybe that's also interesting. I think, you know, one of the things that we've talked about in the past is what is a regular work week for you?
Like you want me to go through like the day?
Yeah, I mean, even go through the history. Like, what was regular at Eloqua? What's regular at Oracle?
I mean, regular at Eloqua was, when I started, I worked 65 days straight, including Sundays, and I did probably 320-hour weeks, which is 15 hours a day, 7 days in a row, which is insane.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that makes any sense.
So okay. Just, I mean, you learned from that.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think it does. I think that you could be a lot more, the thing that's different between them and now and work, how you work is, I think for me, when I know I don't know something, rather than be bullheaded and just try and figure it out, I just ask somebody for help.
Right. That's
and
the
I,
big
and
difference.
I know who to ask. Yeah.
Yeah, you have the network.
That's right.
What kind of an effect does it have on your team when they see you working that hard? Like, presumably you were working that hard because there was just work that had to get done. And I'm imagining as a manager, you're trying to do the managed stuff and also your own work. But did you notice anything in terms of the kind of message that was sending to your team? And did it motivate people to see you working that hard? Or was it something that maybe stressed them out?
And you're talking about back at Eloqua, because
I
don't do...
Yeah, no, exactly. Back in the day.
So it certainly set a culture of working hard on hours matter. I mean, mm-hmm. I understand that. And it burnt some people out. And it burnt me out. And I certainly would do it slightly different. But I will say the caveat to that is... You know, we were a SaaS startup in a world where people didn't buy SaaS and people didn't look at Canada for startups. Mm-hmm. And we were not funded. And so we had no option. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm being asked to lead a digital marketing session with the heads of IntraWest Properties, and I don't know what digital marketing is, I probably have to stay up overnight to learn that so I don't look like an idiot the next day. So yeah. It's stuff like that. Hopefully no one from IntraWest is listening to this.
And now you much more purposeful about managing your time versus staying up all night.
Yes. And maybe it's not as fun at the office because of that, because we all just get focused on getting stuff done and not as much casual time. But I think that it ends up being more effective time.
So, yeah, I mean, that kind of goes, I think when people think of startup environments, they think it's going to be ping pong tables and pinball machines and scooters, and a bunch of beer and young people screaming and yelling and having fun. I think, you know, I don't know. I'm curious for Jillian's opinion here. I don't think that's true at Soapbox. Although I think we do try to have fun, but it's definitely about show up, work really hard, get your stuff out the door. Is that, do you find you're consciously making different cultural decisions with Nudge, the kind of second time around?
I think it is. For me, it's just the only way I can do a startup now with right. family is that we need to focus in the time we're working and then have time off for personal life. There's no real, that's my priority. Mm-hmm. And I think Steve and I, when we look to hire, we make it clear that like, you know, we have a different type of work environment. We don't, you know, we want you to go have dinner with your families or your friends or your boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever. But yeah, we do work late at night and we do work early in the morning and we still try and fit it all in.
Awesome. Okay. So I want to go to kind of some of the more painful things that maybe new managers, have a hard time jumping in. So you mentioned burnout. So how do you know if someone's burning out? What do you do to maybe, you know, pump the brakes on that person? Or how do you know if they're burnt out? What do you do? Do you get rid of them? Do you give them a vacation? How do you deal with burnout?
I think there's two things, parts of that. One is, how do you know if someone is burning out? I think most managers get a sense of that. The harder question is, how long do you let it go for knowing that it still helps the company?
Do you kill this person?
Yeah, do you just keep killing them because they're doing a great job and you need them to kill themselves for the next year, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's a hard, when I ran customer success at Eloqua, you know, we had a pretty big team, I think got almost 100 people towards the end, and we were, in my humble opinion, one of the best customer success organizations in the world, right? We were delivering value, creating a new market with marketing automation, and there were some challenges at one point with the product. And I said to the team, it's not going to be fun, but we got to prop this thing up for the next little while.
Yeah.
And I said to my manager, some of your people may burn out and not be able to stick around just because we've pushed too hard. But this is our strategic advantage. Like, we are good at this.
Yeah.
So we have to take advantage of it as a business. Yeah. And so that's the harder question, is like, how much do you burn them out for, knowing even that some will leave? And is that a good or bad call? At what point do you say, okay, enough's enough, we've lost enough people, or it's a problem?
So going into that, did you have people burn out?
Yeah, we did, definitely.
And what did you do? Was it let them burn out and replace them with fresh blood? Or
so we some of them burnt out enough to just leave.
Yeah.
Some of them we started to say, okay, could we get them into a new role in the company that's different, that still has lots of value? Mm-hmm. And some of them we pulled back on. It just depended on the area. But there were some definitely I knew, and again, extremely hard decisions, but that they were the right people for that job. That job was long and hard and was going to burn them out, but I needed them to do that job.
So what's the one thing, maybe, I guess it's going to be different per person, but if you have a couple tips for people out there who are like, you know, I'm dealing with someone who's burning out. How do you motivate them to put in the extra, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20, an hour when they're dying?
And I want to be clear, like, for those out there listening, like, you do want to try and give some of those people time, right? So like, hey, take a day off, do this, do that. I think the key is, are they through that burnout process? Can you showcase to them, help them, support them, that what they are doing is going to be better for them in their career? What they're learning through that really tough process is actually going to add value to them over, maybe not even at this job, maybe the next job, right? Or are they doing something that's so terrible that it's never going to even help them. That's a much easier decision. Like, let's figure out how to stop that. Let's figure out how to give you a break. But what I try to do is say, what can we find that's the diamond in the rough here, what you're learning that is so great that, yeah, you may burn out a little in doing it for the next little while, but it's going to make your career that much better.
Yeah, and I mean, from my perspective as a non-founder and sometimes having to work really hard and teetering on the edge of the burnout zone, it is helpful to just understand the why. Like, why are we doing this? And when the managers are really upfront with, like, you might burn out. I'm aware of that. And this is why we just need to keep pushing forward. And it doesn't have to be some grand, like, let's all align on the big vision of this company and how we're changing the world. It can be as simple as what you said in terms of, like, we need to prop this up until it's fixed in the product. So we just need to band together. And then for me, if a manager were to just say, like, I need you because you're the best at this and I know it's going to burn you out. So let's just talk about, like, let's just be open and honest, and I can always tell you how the things you're doing are propelling your career or
and all. Yeah, I agree. I agree that it's you admit that, yes, this is, we are burning out. You don't pretend, what are you talking about? And everyone's like this. You say, this is hard work. We know this is really tough. It's going to be a slog. Here's the value both to the business and to yourself. And let's just stay on top of it and let's go as long as we can.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think that's the happy scenario, right? Where you get someone who's, you kind of sense is burning out, but they're still showing up every day and trying. There's got to be a whole bunch of examples you have where people start showing up and not trying. How do you bring that up? And if you do have to part ways with them, what do you do? What do you say?
So I think that the best philosophy on trying to understand performance and, like, if someone's burning out, not doing a good job, is this idea. Like, if you actually think of it, nobody wants to do a bad job. Like, they just don't. People don't like being told they're doing a bad job. They don't like doing a bad job. So what you have to go into the assumption is that something else is stopping them from doing a good job, and you need to find out what that is. And sometimes it's something very straightforward, mm-hmm. like they just don't like the job anymore.
Right.
Sometimes it's something personal, sometimes something that's someone else is affecting them. And once you figure that out, you've got options. One of the biggest mistakes I ever made as an early manager was just assuming people just didn't want to get fired ever.
Right.
And it's actually not true. Sometimes people themselves come to the conclusion, this is no longer the right place for me, but I've invested so much time, I don't know what to do.
I can't quit.
Yeah, I certainly can't quit.
Yeah.
But if you handle it in a way that gives them respect and understand it and have mm-hmm. that discussion and say, you know, it's not working out, what are your thoughts around the situation? You'll be surprised many times to say, yeah, I know.
I can't do it anymore, yeah. But you have to free me.
Yeah. Right. And there are times where it comes as a shock, and then you've done a bad job as a manager understanding that process earlier on, right?
Yep.
And I've had some of those too, for sure.
So I definitely remember my first shock, and it was, oh my God, I've got to change how I manage so that I never get myself. It's like a very selfish thing, right? I've got to manage better so that I am never in this awkward situation where I've just shocked someone that they're gonna be leaving. What do you do to prevent that shock with the employees? Is that all happening in those weekly sessions, or are you doing other things?
I think it happens a bit with direct feedback in the moment. Like, if you had to do one thing as a manager well, is in moment direct feedback while it's happening or just after it's happening,
yep.
positive or negative, right?
Yep.
Because if you wait, everything gets blurry, everything changes. I think that's one thing. The second is you should have a performance management process that forces you to explicitly explain why something is not where they think it is.
Yep.
And a lot of performance management processes leave a lot of room for interpretation of why you didn't get there, why you didn't get this score or that score. And so come up with a process that's explicit. Like, to get this level, here's the three things that you need, and you didn't do this one thing, the third thing.
Yeah.
And force managers to explain that.
So when... I'm assuming, you know, with Alico, as you were hiring managers, how did you coach them to ensure they were doing a good job of that? How did you get visibility into it? How did you kind of ensure that they were leading their team in that way? You had a process, I'm assuming.
I think just being really, really engaged with, I think there's two aspects to it. So one is being really engaged with all the activities and once in a while dipping deep into, say, a customer visit or something, seeing stuff from the front lines at different points in time. I think that's one. And so you're never losing touch with what's happening with the people below the people you're managing.
Yeah.
I think the second is I used to often ask them this question as a way, as a real tactical way to explain what I'm expecting of them, they should expect of their team. Is like, if you really want to try and figure out how to level up the entire organization, the questions you ask me every week, you need to get your team to ask you. And so this idea of passing down levels of questions, and to them they think, well, wait a second, there's no way my direct reports could ask me the questions I ask you because I know all these things. Mm-hmm. And so they start thinking, well, then how do I get my team to know all those things?
Yeah.
And, oh, maybe I need to empower them more to do more stuff so they ask me the questions that I'm asking you. And that frees up them to then think about the next level, things they got to focus mm-hmm. on. And so this idea of passing down questions as a way to tactically explain what you're expecting, yeah. I thought was very effective.
That's a good tip.
That's a great tip. Okay, so we've got 5 minutes left, and it's the super fun part of our podcast called The Secret Question. So, Paul, you've got three cards turned over upside down in front of you with a number 1, 2, and 3. I'd like you to pick one at random, and that's the question you have to answer.
Oh, yeah, it's number one.
All right.
And it's about Brandon's worst secret.
No! Oops, you know.
That one gets slipped in
there. I wonder what it would be, too.
No, it's not. What's the best piece of advice you've received or heard about leading people? You know, I think the best, it's more an experience. Can I give you an experience that taught me something?
100%.
So when I was running CS in Eloqua, I had a director who was really strong in one aspect of the job and not so strong in another aspect of the job. And so under a lot of pressure from that director and just my own thoughts of and moving on fast, I, you know, over a 6-month period promoted them to a vice president, thinking that maybe the part that wasn't so great would be diminished and the part that was great would be amplified. And of course, the exact opposite happened. Mm-hmm. The part that was great reduced and the part that was bad mm-hmm. grew. And so I went back to my CEO and said, I think I made a mistake. I need to let this person go because there's no way to backpedal from promoting someone.
Yeah.
And he said to me, Paul, obviously it's a big mistake, like promoting someone to vice president and then like 30 days later saying you made a mistake, but I'm happy you came to me. But you will never hear about it from me again. I won't hold it over your head. I won't come back to it. I won't make jokes about it because I'd never want you to think that you can't do that again. And so it was a great piece of advice for me because he could have torn me, he could have publicly torn me to shreds for everyone that you never do this. And he held for the last 7 years I worked with him. He never mentioned it ever again. And it gave me the strength of to be completely honest with him about everyone that I was working with and what I was doing, knowing that he would never ultimately hold me responsible for making mistakes as long as I knew how to correct them and get better.
And fix them quickly.
Yeah, and it was a great learning lesson for me and something that hopefully I've also done when I work with other people within my company.
Cool. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for joining us, Paul. We really appreciate it. And then is there any last words you'd like to leave us with, maybe a pitch about your company or anything you're working on right now?
You know, I would say this because a lot of people are in software and tech companies, and why I love this podcast and why I'm happy to be on it is that, you know, I think that customers may come for your service or product, but they're going to stay for the people. And I think if everyone focused a little more on the people side of the business, I think you'd be incredibly surprised with the great success you'll have as a business.
People Leading People is produced by Soapbox and edited by Joel North. Soapbox helps managers lead better by giving them a place to have more productive one-on-ones, team meetings, and company-wide discussions. Go to soapboxhq.com to download our free app. If you liked what you heard today, do us a favor and give us 5 stars in the reviews. And if you're really feeling the love, leave a comment with a secret question you'd like us to ask in an upcoming episode.